Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here on a Wednesday, May the 11th, 2022. 16 minutes past the hour, 64 degrees, mostly sunny skies here in Marion. We thank Jim Renacci for being on with us in hour number one. Now, this hour, we have a very interesting story that we covered earlier, maybe a couple months ago, and we have a good update this morning, and it involves the story going on in the Ukraine. We're going to go through this again, as we did before, but update you on what has happened since last we spoke to Pastor Trevor Littleton, who once was the pastor here of the Rise Church in Marion, now with the First Church of Christ in Painesville, Ohio. Pastor Littleton, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Pastor, for people who haven't heard your story, could you start with the beginning of when war broke out in Ukraine and kind of take us up to present day?
Yeah, so you know, everybody heard the rumors of war of coming. And, you know, for an American, when you hear this and you hear on the news, Russia might be invading Ukraine, an American mind would say, they got to do something, they've got to evacuate, whatever. But, you know, we did our adoption from 2015 to 2017, which obviously predates the war considerably. And even then, there were military checkpoints, there was military presence in Ukraine to prevent from this very situation. So they've been ready for this for a long time. But in many respects, Russia invading Ukraine now really, really capitalizes the boy who cried wolf story. And what that means is like, they've been, oh, we've got Russia tonight, babe. Russia's going to invade. And then they never do. So most of the residents of Ukraine just didn't evacuate because they didn't think it was actually going to happen. Us in America, we're hearing about this. It's probably a bigger deal. So the loved ones that all these Americans have in Ukraine, you know, they just weren't leaving the country because they weren't taking it seriously, my own daughters included. And so when the war started, the first couple of days was like, okay, here's an invasion. This is near the Crimea thing from a couple of years ago, you know, where it's going to be a couple of days of stuff and then it's over with. And then it just never relented. And it just kept getting worse. Now people are dying. It's getting worse. And the boy cried wolf, but it wasn't help. And so here we are.
Tell me
if I had went over.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we had two girls in Ukraine. Both of whom we had tried to adopt, they were just too old. Nastya, who was in Mariupol, she was our oldest son, Sergey, his biological sister, but she was too old to adopt, so we were not able to bring her to America. And then there was another girl, Sasha, who was also too old when we adopted her. She was ineligible for international adoption, but we've talked to her over the years. She's our last name, you know, all that stuff there. We just couldn't bring her to America. Both of those girls were in Ukraine out of the war.
Now, how old are Nastya and Dasha?
So Dasha is now 21. Dasha's 21, Nastya is 27.
Okay. Now, in the beginning, when you heard out that war had broken out in Ukraine, you made contact with both of them, I think, in the beginning.
Yes.
What was their right. feeling in the beginning?
They weren't taking it seriously. I really... Yeah, the boy who cried wolf story is just a big deal for all of us right now because they live under constant war that when that happens, no one took it serious. And so then, obviously, it was a serious matter, and then it happened. At first, they were like, oh, it's okay. Nastya is in the bottom, it's southeast part of Ukraine. She was in the city of Mariupol, places, we're all in the fighting status right now. Like, it is the worst part of the war. We're not, we're suffering from. Dasha was in a city called Lviv, which is in western Ukraine. It was attacked, but it was not as bad as Nasia's area. But both girls kind of discredited everything else.
When did the phone calls start to change?
About a week. I would say it was about a weekend. Maybe not quite a week. We were seeing that everything was intensifying. This might be something a little bit longer. Bombs were hitting a little closer to home. We finally convinced Russia to get on a train and to head to the border because she was much closer. But Nastia just did not think it was going to be as bad. And all of the girls in her world had evacuated. And at the time, those people evacuated. They were not allowing immigrants to cross to Poland. So Nastia told us, she's like, it doesn't matter if I leave, I can't go anywhere. So she just kind of stayed. And then it became more desperate with every day, and then there was no longer a way out, but we could still talk to her. And then it was March 2nd, it was radio silence. From that point, we asked her every day, send us a picture, send us messages, let us know you're okay. And then March 2nd, it all stopped, and we just didn't hear from her anymore.
Now, at one point, you made a trip over to that part of the world.
I did.
Tell us, what drove you over there, and how did you get there, and where did you go?
Well, I mean, one of the things you have to consider is these girls grew up without family. So they grew up without a father figure. They grew up without a father figure. They grew up without anybody fighting for them or advocating for them. So we're trying to get them to safety, and they lack the courage, really, to do it because at this point now it's an overwhelming situation, and they don't know what to do because it's gone too long. So I just knew, like, hey, I've got to show a father's love here, and I've got to do something that these girls need to know there is somebody in their corner who will fight for them hard and who will do things that a parent should be doing for their child. And so if there's any of my other children, I went, and I consider them my daughters, so I went. And I told Dasha, because she was the one who was able to get the phone, that, listen, I will meet you at the border. Just go. We wired her money to go on the train. So here's where it is. Just go, and we will meet you there. And when I get you, I'll take you to safety, we'll get you set up, we'll bring you overseas, and we'll just make it work. Well, that was the thing that got her out. And literally, that we did that, the street she lived on was bombed. Mm-hmm. The very street Dasha lived on was ended up getting hit with shells. So we don't know what would have happened if we not got her out that week.
How did you get to Poland at that point? What was the expense? What did you have to go through? The process.
Yeah, it wasn't cheap. So I had to go. So we had our test. We had done a lot of missions. Well, I went to book a ticket, and my passport was expired. I didn't realize it was expired by, like, I think, a week. It was something small. And so I had to hurry up and get a passport expedition appointment here in America. So I had to call the passport service. They said the only available opportunity I have is to go to Arkansas the next day. So I book a flight, fly to Arkansas, stand in line all day, get my passport renewed, fly back home. I ended up having the flu when I was down there, so I was sick. You can imagine, on the plane, going through everything. I come home, get settled for the day, book my ticket to Poland. It was like a day or two later, I fly over to Poland. And international travel right now is very challenging because there's so many protocols with COVID still that exist overseas, especially. And it was all extra hoops to jump through, extra stuff to deal with. It was a lot. It really was.
What was Poland like back in March?
Oh, dear. I'll be honest, man. Going into Poland that first run, it was a very foreboding point. Like, I think the only way I have to explain to people is it was just a very heavy feeling. It was like we flew into Paris with our connection, and then from Paris we went to Warsaw. But in Paris, on the connecting flight, all it was Red Cross, clergy, journalists, and retired military. It was pretty much all of us on a flight together, 100% relief effort. And you have soldiers kind of readying themselves to cross the border and do some relief work, and no one knows how heavy that's going to be. You have journalists who are, $60 pass, and they were putting that, and you just, it was a very heavy environment. And even though Warsaw is abundant space, you know, it is, I cannot express how safe it was in Poland, but the people who were going there were not going to enjoy that safety. We were all going to the border. And so you just had that, the way I can describe it is a very foreboding feeling. And then once I had acquired Dasha and she was safe, we went to grab something to eat one night, and I'll never forget this. We were standing outside this Polish restaurant, and there were a very multicultural group of people around us. And there were some Italians, some people from Spain, and some people from Russia, who were all like us to go in. And the sentiment, even from the Russians, was not good toward Russian invasion. The aggression toward just regular citizens of Russia was very heavy. So the political layering of this was there. And then to add another layer onto it, the hotel we stayed at was at the airport in Poland. And it was the same night that Kamala Harris had arrived there to do a speech. And so now you have the frustration of Russian politics. Then you were layered with, here's an American diplomat, and they're shutting traffic down, and everybody's frustrated there. It was just a lot of tension and a lot of heavy feeling at that particular juncture.
Now, tell me about the reunion with Dasha at that point.
Mm-hmm. No, it was great. You know, I hadn't seen her. The way things went down, we were not able to get an American visa. We just couldn't do it. We tried for so long, we just couldn't. So I haven't seen her in person. We video chat all the time. We talk all the time, you know, on social media and whatever. We're in contact often. But to actually physically be together, you know, it was there. And it was great to see her. It was a very fearful reunion. I felt very guilty that I was the one who had that privilege and not, you know, my wife or my kids, who all of us miss her. So, you know, I felt kind of guilty there that I was the one who got the share in that. But it was good.
Now, once you had reunited with her, where did she go at that point? Now, she's in Poland. How does that
work? She's no longer in Poland. She was in Poland then. So, I'll get to that. She was originally at a camp. It was like a church camp. The only way I can explain it. It was like a church camp with about 180 other Ukrainian refugees. And she was safe. I met staff. I was very fatherly. I wanted to meet people who were there and who were feeding her and taking care of her. I wanted to make sure something was safe. And we all had our talks. And I felt very, very safe with that crew. So I felt safe enough to leave because at the time there were no visas available for her still, even with all this. So I had to leave there in Poland, but I knew she was safe. So on that note, it was okay. And then I came home and Canada opened up the process that Ukrainian citizens who were refugees could go directly into Canada and then have, within 2 years, get full citizenship. They can open a bank account right away, a job right away. There's all stuff to do right away. So we talked to Dasha and said, hey, right now there's not a visa for America. Would you okay coming to Canada? Because Toronto is not very far from where we live. We can see you all the time. You want to do this? So she was like, without rival, yes, I want to do this. I need to come over. And so we did. And that's pretty much what we did. And that's what we're doing now. So we moved from Poland to Germany. And after a brief stint in Germany, the Canadian embassy in France was much quicker to work with these citizens. So we moved her from Germany to France. And that's where she presently is. She's approved and everything for a passport. We're just waiting for her to receive it in the mail.
When it comes to Dasha, when you first met up with her, what were her stories like of Ukraine that she had just left?
You know, Dasha's stories were good. She was terrified that the street she lived on had just left. I mean, we had no scooter, got her out. It was a couple of days. Her scooter was hit with all the shelling. So that was terrifying because Dasha, there is a bunch of ifs. Like, if we didn't get her out, what would have happened? So that's terrifying. She did have a boyfriend behind, and he enlisted in the army, and he is presently fighting for Ukraine. so we feel awful about that as well. That's a lot to go through. That's a lot to work. So we know, you know, they've got that going for them. And we're very proud of what he's done there. But for Dasha, it's just a lot of what if. She herself did not experience a lot of the trauma before she left because we got her out in time. Nastia is a very, very, very different situation entirely.
When it before we get to Nastia, when it comes to refugees into America right now, what is the sentiment? What is being said to somebody who would like to see your daughter come here to be with you?
Yeah. So they just started. One of our frustrations, and the first time I talked to you, you know, we were talking about the visa process because it was a very big challenge to get anybody here. And I think the American sentiment is we want to protect our borders. We know that. That is the obvious. However, we are also a compassionate nation in that if there are people who need help, genuinely, we're going to help them. And so I've not yet run into anybody who's like adamant against helping Ukrainian refugees. I think that speaks to itself in common sense. I think the way we have to do it, though, is how can we help these Ukrainian refugees while being fair to other international citizens around the world who might need help? I Afghanistan refugees when that situation happened back in the summer or another country. And so the government did take a long time to debate this, to work through this, and to figure out how to best help. But I will admit, since my last talk with you, they have opened up a program where we can bring Nastia straight to America. The minute I get her, we'll talk about here in a moment, the minute I'm there with her one-on-one, I can fly her directly to Sweden without a problem. That is since we've talked. And Biden finally announced a couple weeks ago this United for Ukraine situation. Our local House representative here is Dave Joyce. I've spoken with both Dave Joyce's office and Jim Jordan's office. We're all pretty comfortable with where we are with the situation. Once we can acquire her, get her out of Ukraine, we feel very good about Nastia's situation on an immigration and refugee level.
Nastia, 27 years old, take us through this. Her area was harder hit. You had conversation with her, I believe, last we spoke in early March. What were those conversations like? And then tell us what has happened since.
So I have, March 2nd was when we left for summer. And then, you know, when I went to Poland to get Dasha, the original sentiment that I had was, I'm just going to try to kill some time over in Poland because surely I'm going to hear from Nastia and I can bring her over. And then we never heard. I had to come back home. 43 days went by before we heard from Nastia. And, you know, you're reading the news, Mariupol is ground zero for this. And it is a literal hell on earth. And the coverage we had, we were getting news from Telegram, we were getting our news from other people we knew in the area who lived there. These are people we know, their houses we made that have blown up. We know these people. We're just nothing to Nastia. So we're getting to the point where we knew there were several instances of mass graves. The death toll is rising significantly. We were finally getting to the point where we're starting to ask the questions like, is she gone or will we ever know what really happened or whatever? And then, one morning, I think it was Thursday morning, I had a meeting. And I was in a meeting with his family at church, and we just sat down to start talking, and Shana called me, and I knew she knew I was in a meeting, so I declined to call. And she sent me a text and said, call me now. So I'm like, okay, I got to do this. So I leave the meeting, and I take the call, and the only words she said was, she's alive. And I'm like, what? She said, no, she's alive. And what had happened was she had snuck away to a part of Mariupol where they could have very limited cell phone reception. And there was a citizen there, there was a resident, who had a Spanish cell phone. And Spanish is in the actual country thing. And so she took the SIM card out of that phone and put it in her own phone and called her boss, who it was the only number she could memorize because all the stuff on the phone got wiped. So she called her boss because she remembered a phone number, and we've been in contact with this woman through all the process here. So she called her boss, and they talked for 9 minutes. It was a very broken conversation. She got cut off a lot, but she was able to stay alive in roughly the part of town that she was in. And then they lost the call. So, you know, we were all very excited for that. And it was maybe another week later that we were able to get contact with her a little bit more solid. We had relocated to another part of the town. They were able to have a little bit of cell reception in the fun, it's like a town square that people would go to call because there was some cell reception there. So they were able to move out. It was a little bit of a safer part of town. But, now she has since escaped Mariupol. She had to take what's called a filtration bus. And filtration is the process that she's in now. It is not the greatest option, but it's the only way she can get out of Mariupol. So what she is in now is it's like a Russian-controlled evacuation route. And she's waiting for a date in June where she can basically interview her way out of. They will have to take her phone and they plug it into a computer and they scan all conversations, pictures, whatever, web browsing, whatever, to see what anti-Russian sentiment that she has expressed. And then they will look through her records to see if she has any connection to a soldier in the Ukraine army, of which we think she's clear at all for that. And once she passes that, then they'll let her out up north into Russia where she can go west into Estonia. And then once she's there, I'll meet her anywhere between Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, or Poland. One of those countries I'll meet her in.
During this 43 days when you did not hear from her, what was life like? At one point you said you even had to consider there were mass graves, horrible things were going on. How do you get through that?
You don't. I mean, honestly, you know, I've been in this now for going on, I think, 25 years. And I have done a lot of, I've been in part of some pretty gnarly stuff. And nothing can be for stuff like this. I mean, it really felt like my daughter was kidnapped. You may never know whatever happened. And it was madness. I mean, it was madness. It was just a very numbing feeling to go day to day. And you just really had to hope for yourself that I get something to hold on to. Deceased. I just want to know whatever happened. But, you know, you're hearing so many horror stories of what's going on overseas, what's happening to these women, what's happening to people coming and going. And, you know, I'm very glad to know that she was safe through a lot of that. But the things that she has seen, just even what she shared with us, has been pretty gruesome.
What has she been able to tell you?
So I know evacuated her apartment under the gunfire. They stayed in her apartment for 3 weeks as it was being shelled. She stayed in her apartment. She had cats. She wanted to stay with her cat. So I tell you, there is no stronger love in the world than a Ukrainian woman and a cat. I have learned this throughout the war. But she just refused to leave. So before she left contact, she had made one, the last conversation we had with her, she made one big grocery store run. So she limited her diet to one egg per day, which, you know, after a little bit of time, those eggs even okay. She had one egg per day, and they melted snow to drink. That's how they got through 3 weeks there at the apartment. After her apartment was shelled very, very badly, Ukrainian citizens who were hungry and starving were going door to door and kicking doors of apartment buildings open and raiding places for food, supplies, and water, or whatever they could find. When that happened, she had a biological cousin came and got her under gunfire, like they were literally shot at, comes in there, gets her out of her apartment. They stayed a couple of days in the basement of her apartment building before it became dangerous. So then they left to go to another location. We heard from her finally at that location. At that point, she said, as they were walking along, one of the things they had witnessed was Russian soldiers were going door to door houses and shooting people and burying them in their own backyard. I was like, true. Gnarly stuff. And then they made it home where they were in, which was like, at the time, the northwestern part of Mariupol, which was a little bit safer. It wasn't quite Russian controlled yet. It was less fighting, less stuff happening there. So she had a little bit of time to take a deep breath before she got out of the nest. But one of her close friends had a little girl who I think maybe 5 or 6 years old. And she said that the mother of the girl was shot and killed. So then her close friend now has to raise this girl. I think it was her little sister or whatever. So they've also got that to deal with. So she sent me a picture of her and a little girl and everything there. That's the stuff I can say on it.
What impact do you think this has had on this 27-year-old girl?
You know, anytime you endure trauma, high-level trauma, you know, if it's an auto accident, if you've seen some stuff you need not see, it shapes you as a person, changes your world, you kind of the filter by which you see the world. And I know for her, this was it, man. I mean, it's going to change her. It's going to add some wisdom where, you know, you call somebody an old soul. She might be 27, but she really acts like an old soul. She really, she's been through more than a normal 27-year-old would have endured.
So at this point, she is in, was it Russian control?
It's an area called Donetsk, which is still in Ukraine, but it's a Russian-occupied part of Ukraine.
And they're very serious about security at this point, which is what the current hang-up is.
Yeah, and we have to be guarded with what we talk about with her. So, like, when we talk all the time now, it's more just like, hey, how's your day, and, like, plans upcoming and stuff. And that's it. Like, there are certain words we don't use. We don't say Russia because they ping for that. We always have to be careful and guarded that, you know, whatever conversations we have are going to be intercepted somehow. So there's a little bit on the immigration side we cannot do presently because we're afraid if she started her own paperwork on her side. There's stuff we have to do in America on our end, and there's stuff she has to fill out on hers. We can't start her process until we get her full in. Which is something we've talked about with the House of Representatives office here in Marion.
What do you make of the whole situation now, the whole Ukraine-Russia situation?
No, it's awful. I mean, it's just an awful situation. And it is a confusing one where you really have to ask yourself, what does Russia have to gain from this? And I think for me, one of the things that's working is bringing Dasha. There are a couple of Facebook groups that exist as far as Canadian citizens, I'm sorry, Ukrainian citizens going to Canada. And what is very frustrating is these people are needing help from a place to stay for a year or two. And so it looks like a dating website where here's a picture of, you know, a man or a woman or of a family. And it's like, hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm 34 years old. I'm a software engineer. Here's a picture of me, my wife, my cat. And maybe people look at here's a picture of whatever, and we need a place to stay for 2 years because our house was blown up on top of the state. I mean, it's that. These are not third world stuff. These are very good sovereign citizens who have been displaced because a leader just decided he wanted more real estate. And it is no different than another country invading Marion. I mean, it's heinous what is happening.
It seemed like in the beginning that the United States was very, the United States people were very interested in getting involved and helping out when we saw these horrible pictures. Should the United States, in your opinion, be involved?
Not militarily. I don't think they want to be involved militarily because I think the Ukraine party handled themselves pretty well. There are a lot more Russian casualties right now. Team. The Ukraine is fighting very well. And, you know, it's a very different world when you're defending your own homeland. You know what to do. And there's an element of pride. One of the things that we're hearing from Russian soldiers who are captured is they don't even know what their orders are. Like, they just go in to cause havoc, and that's pretty much it. But no, I don't think we can help militarily, like sending soldier groups. What I do believe, though, is we do kinds of equipment. I'm very much in favor of that, because I think if we just did one treasure trove of here's some hard round stuff that we can send over, I think some of this would end a little bit quicker on that end. And then just the diplomacy end of it all. I wish there were better ways, better channels that we could negotiate, which obviously those don't exist.
Do you think at the end of this that no matter what happens, that Putin will be satisfied to leave Ukraine without capturing Ukraine?
Oh, no. No, he won't. Because he is a man driven by pride. And even in a military loss, still would declare victory somehow. He would still find a way to make it like I won to the Russian people. And the propaganda that he uses in Russia is, I mean, I understand we have our faces here. I lean on the conservative end of things here, but we've not seen propaganda like it is in Russia.
What do you think this has done to your daughters, being around the propaganda, being around what was war, seeing a land that they loved, that they went back to, destroyed like this? Obviously two different situations, but overall, what do you think the long-term effects of this will be?
You know, Dasha is going to be a little bit, she's younger, and she's a little bit more, 21, so she's in that stage of life where, you know, girls that age, boys that age, they want to have fun, they want to do whatever, and I think she's just learning seriousness and the severity of this. Nastia, I guess in Mariupol, one of the things that was happening was when they cut off all communication, Russian troops and information was starting to gather through there, where the Russians were telling citizens of Mariupol, Ukraine's not going to come defend you because Ukraine doesn't want you in their country. We as Russia have come in to save you. We've come in to help you. We've come in to liberate you. And so there was just a lot of, you know, brainwashing that really was going on. And so I think for Nastia, some of that is yet to be finished. When we finally get her out, she can back in retrospect on it. There's just going to be a lot of reflection on this here.
What is the timetable right now, or what do you feel the timetable is for her coming back to Ohio?
It's looking like June.
June.
Right now. Like, we feel pretty good that June is probably going to be when this happens.
When she returns here, what do you foresee happening? Obviously a very happy reunion, but
yeah.
What do you think is going to have to happen?
Probably at least a 2-year period where she'll be at least able to stay here for 2 years. And then, you know, there's some things we can apply for longer tenure stuff. And we will go through that process. One of the things we're seeing is a lot of this is a shifting table, very shifting political landscape as far as what the immigrants and refugees are able to do now versus what they may allow in a couple of years. For instance, a low rate of citizenship. Canada has implemented that, and I have noticed that America's kind of followed Canada on some of their process with similar things. So we're hopeful that we can at least get some type of citizenship out of this.
Have we learned any lessons from this as Americans? We've watched it. We've commented on it. Have we learned any lessons?
I think some of the lessons we've learned, it's 2022, and we've been all perspective and things can happen. You never know. One leader makes a decision to cause harm, and you never know how you can get involved. And I think these are human beings just like us in America who need relief, and are willing to help them. And how can we go through that? And you know, we feel a little helpless with all the things we can be doing.
With two daughters in this, 27 and 21 years old, and obviously what we would say skin in the game, what lessons have you learned that maybe heretofore you had not thought about?
What we do to help people matters. And I think you have to be willing and ready to just drop in a hat and go put up your family. And there seems to be a lot of urgency in how you help people. And when someone needs help, you cannot just sit around and wait. You have to You have to jump in and go. Sometimes it's going to hurt. The sacrifice is there. It's not pleasant. But sometimes the right thing is to do the unpleasant thing.
As a pastor, as a man of faith, and we have about 10 minutes left here, war is a very difficult thing for anybody to define or describe. As a pastor, how do you describe war? How do you cope with it? How do you come to terms with it?
I mean, war is different. You see it often throughout, and you see some people who are major heroes of faith as men of war, and women of war. You have women who, you look at Judges 4 and Judges 5, you have a woman who is commanded for her own act of, you know, kind of savagery a little bit in war. So, I mean, you have leaders of the country like Deborah who are commanded over leadership in power, or you have other women who are there as well, who are, you know, notable for this. So, war is biblical, unfortunately, because we are a fallen world. We live in a fallen world, and a fallen world has people who may fall into prison, and this is a consequence of the world we live in. I think there are things to be said, such as valor and such as wisdom, that are to be attained from that. And I also would advocate, one of the things that I've been very strong with has been, you know, Jesus surrounded himself with rugged figures. You know, Peter, his name was Simon, Jesus changes his name to the rock. Like, how cool are you that, you know, the God of the universe has, I'm not going to leave you with Simon anymore. You're the rock now. Like, you know, there's that. James and John were followers of Jesus and changed their names to Galactus, the Sons of Thunder. Like, what kind of leader are you that Jesus changes your name to the Son of Thunder? I mean, that's pretty cool. And then another person who Jesus surrounded himself with, one of his disciples, was Simon the Zealot, who was an insurrectionist soldier. So, I mean, Jesus himself surrounds, as his own disciples, rough and rugged men. Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. She comes from a rough background. You see some very strong men and women together around the person of Jesus. And it begs the question, as far as faith is concerned, you know, sometimes being a person of faith, you have to be a tough individual to do some of the things that God has called you to do. These aren't pleasant things. We don't live in a comfort bubble. I mean, it's sometimes a hard, savage world we live in, and sometimes God calls us to do very tough, steep tasks, but at the end of the day, you have to follow through and do it.
When it comes right down to the scenes that you were describing that Nastia had to go through, seeing mothers shot and other people killed and having to bust into houses to get food and eating one egg, how do we cope with that? How do we say that that's okay? Is it free will? Is it a test that God is putting us through? How does a man of faith deal with that?
Her own response was, God got me through. God will get me through. God has helped me this far. God will take me the rest away. And I think, you know, all of us, when we take or whatever, we all have a different reaction to the same thing. And she has chosen to be that woman of who, she's been very strong with, God has protected me, God has taken me with, you know, through here. And I have to commend her for it, because that is a very strong thing. She very much could have looked at it and said, why did God allow this, and I'm going to angry with him, but she didn't. She knew in those moments when she was hungry in her apartment, had no electric, no water, she's crying, she's alone, you know, God's going to get me through this. And I think that is a very strong testament of faith.
Before she gets back here, being in Russian care right now and having to go through what is going on, what is your biggest fear at this point before she gets back here?
I fear make it the rest of the way. Like, I want to make sure she's got the strength. She has a boyfriend she dated for a while, also in some of we know they won't let him out right away. So we just worked on some of the timing with that. We promised her we're going to work on to America as well, but they probably won't be together. So just getting some of the courage to go through that. It's life and it's partnership, and when you endure something, I know they were separated for a while after this, got together to evacuate. You know, when you endure problems like that, you kind of have a relationship with you together, and that's very understandable. So, yeah, we just worry for him, worry for, you know, her to have the courage to make it the rest of the way out.
Now, at this point, do you feel that she is being treated well? You said there are only certain things you can say at this point because of the care that she's in. Do you think she's being treated well?
So far, I do. I just think that continues. We've heard some stories of what happens on the other side of this, but I think at this stage of the war, things are a little bit more stable in the process because more eyes are watching than we're watching. And she does not have any ties to anything military-wise, so I think that alone will allow her back. We've told her, if you really get in a pinch, not to express you have American ties right away, but if you do get into a pinch, then make sure they know that because there are options there. That's what we were advised on by people who were there of how they handle the situation. We're honoring that. But, some pretty calmal stuff.
With about 3 minutes left to go, what is your overall feeling? Because Vladimir Putin has been friends with the United States, has not been friends, has met with presidents, has not met with presidents. As somebody who is the father of children who were involved in this, what's your feeling on this man?
On Vladimir Putin?
Yeah.
I think there are a few words in the Book of Jude that deal with them, and it talks about blackest darkness being reserved for judgment. And I think he has qualified himself to receive that judgment. He has very much harmed women and children. He has very much harmed innocent people for the sake of pushing his own name. And I think Scripture itself speaks to, when it says words like blackest darkness is reserved for people like this, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, and I will, as a person of faith, I'll hold that quote.
With 2.5 minutes left to go, you talked about Nastia getting through on her faith. How has your faith been? This is a lot of stuff. Going over there, going to Poland, Dasha coming to Canada, hopefully, Nastia coming to back to Ohio, not talking to her for 40-something days. How has your faith been through this entire thing?
My faith has been, when I say challenge, I've just learned a lot. What it takes to just be ready to go, what it takes to stop and advise, what it takes to just know that somehow this is going to be okay, even when it doesn't seem like it. We've really been hit a lot with God providing. This has not been cheap, this process. So God providing, funding for, fights. And, every week we have to pay money for Dasha for her food, for her lodging, because, she's not allowed to work. But we're paying for everything for her right now. So the providence of all of this and everything in between. There's just been a lot of moments where we've built a lot of faith. And I always ask the question, God, what are you doing through this? And just to really kind of put together what lessons I'm learning. And I have to recognize myself that there's things I'm learning now that I don't even know I'm learning. So we finally have Nastia home. We can all take a big, deep sigh of relief. And Dasha will be in Canada. And Dasha will be in our home. And we can all just kind of look back and then have faith things hit us again. That's what we really learned.
Pastor Trevor Littleton of the First Church of Christ in Painesville, Ohio, was once here in Marion at the Rise Church. It's an amazing story. Keep us updated. We hope Nastia gets home just fine, and maybe when she does, we can meet up and do an interview in person.
We can do that. We would need a translator, but I can bring her brother.
We'll do it. Hey,
he can do that for
me. Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye. Pastor Trevor Littleton, what an amazing story that has been. Now, there's firsthand knowledge of things going on in Ukraine that have been certainly awful, and we hear about on the news every day. Glenn Coble coming up here in about 15 minutes. Don't you tune away from your radio. This is WWGH Radio, 107.1 FM. Scott Spears along with you for the ride. You're listening to WWGH Radio, 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio, the talking place for legendary comedian and the voice of Ursula in The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
And as I teased before we went to the break there, we have on today a lady who I've had on the program, I believe, two times before. But every time she comes on, I am